Grant me the serenity to accept the things that cannot change, the courage to change the things that can, and the wisdom to know the difference. The Simple Actions Group wishes to extend a warm welcome to all in attendance today. These premises are non-smoking. Our group is welcome to use this room and the restrooms exclusively. Newcomers, is there anyone here in their first 30 days of sobriety? We would like to welcome you.
Eli.
Derek.
Welcome.
Raj, welcome. Vivek, welcome. And those on Zoom, you can raise your hand and someone will chat with you. At this time, please silence your cell phones. Also, we respectfully ask that those present, please refrain from unnecessary moving around the room. This will keep distractions and disturbances to a minimum and allow everyone to listen uninterrupted. This group practices the spiritual foundation of the Vanadimity, singleness of purpose and effective sponsorship. It is the purpose of this meeting to carry that clear message and to focus on precisely how to recover from the illness of alcoholism by taking AA's simple action, AA preamble. Alcoholics Anonymous is a fellowship of men and women who share their experience, strength, and hope with each other that they may solve their common problem and help others to recover from alcoholism. The only requirement for membership is a desire to stop drinking. There are no dues or fees for AA membership. We are self-supporting through our own contributions. AA is not allied with any sect, denomination, politics, organizations, or institutions. Does not wish to engage in any controversy, neither endorses nor opposes any causes. Our primary purpose is to stay sober and to help other alcoholics to achieve sobriety. The format of this meeting is an open big book step study. As a group, we recognize the power of one alcoholic identifying with another alcoholic, sharing their experience, strength, and hope from the book Alcoholics Anonymous. We encourage you to engage in conversation and ask questions after the meeting pertaining to the step discussed tonight. This evening, we are discussing steps 8 and 9. Please welcome our panel this evening. And this is Ross and Grace. Sorry about that. I will read the first paragraph on page 80, and then the panel will share for a few minutes on each on the reading. Moving on. Page 80. The chances are that we have domestic troubles. Perhaps we are mixed up with the women in a fashion we wouldn't care to have advertised. We doubt if, in this respect, alcoholics are fundamentally much worse than other people. But drinking does complicate sex relations in the home. After a few years with an alcoholic, a wife gets worn out, resentful and uncommunicative. How could she be anything else? The husband begins to feel lonely, sorry for himself. He commences to look around in the nightclubs or their equivalent for something besides liquor. Perhaps he is having a secret and exciting affair with the girl who understands. In fairness, we must say that she may understand, but what are we going to do about a thing like that? A man so involved often feels very remorseful at times, especially if he is married to a loyal and courageous girl who has literally gone through hell for him. Take it away.
Okay, we decided I'm going to go first on this one. Grace, I'm an alcoholic.
Grace.
And I'm a woman, and I'm not married. And when I got here, I'll qualify first. We've got some newcomers in the rooms, and I started drinking at a young age, and it did for me what I needed to be done. And that was made me feel good about myself and comfortable in my own skin. And I kept doing it until it caused me so many problems that I had to find something, another way to live my life. And so moving into this step 9, I was married for a long time, and I had 4 children with the same man. And I chose alcohol over that marriage, and he killed himself as a result of my choices. Although I did find with a lot of step work that I just wasn't that powerful. But when I got here, I remember telling my first sponsor, like the first week she was sponsoring me, I said, oh, and by the way, I killed my husband. And she said, and the way I said it, she thought I literally killed my husband. And she said, well, are you through the legal issues yet? And so that was the depth of my responsibility for that when I got here. That was how deeply I felt that. And so when I hear this paragraph read, the damages that I caused, the harms that I caused because of the choices I made, were grave. And the amends, the process of those amends, particularly to my now dead ex-husband, have been in the form of a living amends. It took a long time for that attitude of mine to shift, and a lot of stuck work, probably 3 or 4 years. And it through staying sober and doing this thing, what finally started to shift was the way I stopped talking about him the way I'd always talked about. I took those actions. I would have told you, I was never one of those women that badmouth their ex-husband to their children. But the truth was, the way, the tone in my voice, the language of my body, all of that stuff was very clear to everyone who heard me exactly what I thought of him and exactly what a victim I was of him. And I had not taken full responsibility for the choices I had made. And, you know, that second part in step 8, which I think, you know, the first part is, you know, we make a list, sounds pretty simple. It's that second part, and became willing to make amends to them all. And that was something, that was for my higher power. That I had to do the footwork consistently, day after day, aware of the way I spoke about him, aware of the comments I would make, to practice shutty, as I like to call it, sometimes just not saying anything, keeping my mouth shut. And then one day I noticed that I had nothing but fondness left. I had nothing but good memories. And so when I hear that, what was just read, you know, I don't get to get that relationship back. They're all going to die, by the way. So moving forward into this, the way I carry that memory forward is how I make the amends.
Thanks, Grace. Hi, everybody. I'm Ross. I'm an alcoholic.
I'm Ross.
My sobriety date is January 23rd, 2015. I have a home group. It's called the We Are Not Saints group. We meet out offshore drive in Chicks Beach. And I have a sponsor today, and I have a relationship with my sponsor, which means that I call him and I meet with him. And we have, you know, these long, deep talks at his kitchen table, just like it was in the beginning. It's still kind of that way today. It's not as frequent because he's rather busy and I'm rather busy, but it does happen on a regular basis. January 23rd, 2015, started out just about like every other day leading up to that. I woke up in terror. I woke up fearful. I woke up crawling out of my skin, and there was only one way to solve the way that I felt, and that was to drink. And I'd woken up that way for many, many years. And for me, drinking didn't start out that way. I always liked to party. And I always like to have more than my fellow man, but you see, there just wasn't all the problems that were adding up. And you do that for 21 years, or when I did that for 21 years, it just ended up in torture. And even with that torture on January 23rd, 2015, I still didn't have the power to not drink. I still had to, even though I didn't want to. And there were many factors that finally led to me to ask for help on that particular day. I was financially in ruin. My employer did not want to have me around anymore. My parents and my in-laws had changed the locks on the doors to their homes. And this first sentence here that we read, the chances are that we have domestic troubles. I too had domestic troubles. My boys at the time were 8 and 4, and I'd been married for 12, 13 years, something like that. And on that January 23rd, I'd backed myself into a web of lies. And I don't know if anybody else kind of at the end of your drinking, you backed yourself into a web of lies, but that's where I was. And on that day, my wife said, "You're gone." You know, I had all these problems, I had all these issues, but she said, "I'm out of here." And it took that for me to say, "I need some help." I wasn't willing to ask for help at any other point, even though I should have asked for it years in advance. It took all of that domestic trouble, financial ruin, you know, all the things, but it was that I'm out of here. You're out of here for me to do something about. And, you know, later that day, I checked myself into treatment as a 36-year-old man for the very first time. And it was there that I met you people. And you all told me about a program of action. And you said that if I do the things that you do, then I can get sober. And not only can I get sober, but I can live a reasonably happy life. And that's exactly what happened. I was in so much pain, you know, again, the physical, the mental, the emotional, I was in all the pain that you can imagine. And you guys finally told me about that way out. And it was because of that pain, I believe, that I was finally willing to do something about it. And what was that something? It was just to mimic you guys. And as we'll talk about it, we'll keep reading a little bit. And I'll tell you the actions that I took, not only to get to step nine, I didn't just jump right into it. Grace and I shared a similar way to make amends before coming into AA. And my favorite way to make amends was to just not say anything about it. We're just going to forget all the havoc that I just caused over the last weekend of drinking every minute of every hour that the weekend lasted. We're just going to forget about all that and we'll be okay. And that was my favorite way to make amends. And through this process, I've learned a new way. I've learned a new way, not just to get through it the first time, but I make plenty of mistakes. And it gives me the ability to right those wrongs that I'm still making today. So we'll get into that a little bit.
Thank you, Bob. Thanks, Bob. Our next reading is from page 82. If we have no such complication, there is plenty we should do at home. Sometimes we hear an alcoholic say that the only thing he needs to do is to keep sober. Certainly he must keep sober, for there will be no home if he doesn't. But he is yet a long way from making good to the wife or parents whom for years he has so shockingly passing all understanding as the patients, mothers, and wives have had with alcoholics. Had this not been so, many of us would have no homes today, perhaps be dead. The alcoholic is like a tornado, roaring his way through the lives of others. Hearts are broken, sweet relationships are dead, affections have been uprooted, selfish and inconsiderate habits have kept the home in turmoil. We feel a man is unthinking when he says that sobriety is enough. He is like the farmer who came up out of his cyclone cellar to find his home ruined. To his wife, he remarks, "Don't see anything the matter here, Ma. Ain't it grand the wind stopped blowing?"
Grace, I'm an alcoholic. Grace. I love that. Don't see nothing wrong here. Oh my God. Oh my God. When I came out, I'm a product of a, thank you for reminding me. I have a sobriety date too. and home group and sponsor.
Thank God.
Sometimes. Never, no, I'm kidding. My sobriety date is August 31, 2011. And my home group is Big Book Chesapeake. We meet on Sundays at 5:30. So if you're got nothing to do on a Sunday afternoon, please. So I'm a product of a rehab, and I only went to one, which I found out at the late age of 52 was rare. I couldn't believe it when I got there, and there were people who had been to like 19 rehabs. I'm like, who's paying for all this? Because I didn't have any health insurance. I didn't go to doctors. And the last thing I ever wanted to do prior to that moment in time was get sober or ask for help. So, but anyway, when I got out of that rehab, and I came up out of the cellar and looked around and I thought, oh, everything's great. I'm not drinking. And the only people left standing around me, but out of the four children, only two were left, and a cat and a dog. And the dog I had just about killed. And my brother who I gave my children away, he brought the dog back before my daughter. My daughter did not want to come back. He deposited my dog though at my doorstep because he had peed on everything he owned. And I still have that Chihuahua, as a matter of fact, Bruiser. But it was a mess. It was a mess. And we were homeless and I was unemployable. I would have told you I just couldn't get a job, but I was unemployed. And I had a 20-year-old 3/4-ton Suburban that got 8 miles to the gallon. And that was it. And I had to, and nobody else wanted anything to do with me, but I couldn't wait to shout the news to my poor mother and my sister and these family members who had begrudgingly helped me about everything that I was doing in Alcoholics Anonymous on a daily basis. And they politely listened to me and then would talk about and just say, she's lost her mind. She's crazy. I'm telling them about the third step and I'm, you know, meanwhile, have you got a job yet? Have you got a job yet? But I'm not drinking. So there was plenty that had to be done. And little by little, two of the kids that were still with me, that one wasn't a kid, he was a grown man. He had he had been raising the other ones though while I was drunk. And he wasn't going anywhere until he knew that I was gonna stay sober. And he stayed around for quite a few years, but it was a mess. And so I went to meetings every single day. And when it talks about in here, you know, just not drinking is just not it. There were times that I was never a present mother, and I certainly didn't pop out of that rehab and become one. I put my sobriety before everything. And I don't know if that was right, wrong, or indifferent. But I sure stayed sober and I sure went to meetings every day. And there were times when as things started coming back, when the daughter wanted to move back home, when I got fired from the third job and my son that had left the day after he graduated high school, I was a year sober, I think at the time, and I'd gotten fired again sober. And there's a doorbell rings and in walks my second son with all of his belongings and says, "Mommy, I'm home." And I said, "Come on in." But I kept going to meetings and I kept doing this thing. But little by little, I started to learn how to be a present mother, present parent. And I started, and I'll talk about it more, but my father died while I was still drinking. He passed in 2008, and there wasn't enough vodka on the planet for that man's death. And I thought they didn't know I was drinking. I really believed it. I had quit drinking in 1987 when a really bad wreck had happened. And I didn't drink anything for 13 years. I didn't come to AA. I didn't do anything but not drink. And 13 years later, I picked up again and I was off to the races for 10 more years. But I really believe they didn't know I was drinking. Now I am a real alcoholic. I mean, I don't drink pretty little glasses of wine. I'm down in a half gallon of Aristocrat vodka a day for years. So when my father died, it was not pretty. But my mother, who I was so angry with, and when I think about amends, she was my toughest relationship and my best teacher. And I come to find out she was the one that paid for that rehab and she paid cash. And I was so pissed off at her. I was so pissed. I didn't know it. And she did not want me to know she was paying for it. So one of the brothers that took one of my children, he alluded that he paid for it so that I would go. And I found out later she had paid. But those sweet relationships with my mom, I got to spend the next 7 years of her life, the last 7 years of her life, calling her every single night after a meeting, spending every week or one weekend a month with her every month for 7 years. And the last 2 years of her life, I was there once a month and once a week and then every day. And she was pitiful. I mean, I will tell you that she was the most self-centered human being I have ever met in my life, other than me. And you guys taught me what that was all about. And I could see it in her. And then I could realize what it was in me that was so troublesome. And she was a trip. And she came to live with me for a little bit. She was there about 2 weeks. And she told me she was calling an Uber to go home. That I was not paying enough attention to her. But I was there the when she took her last breath. And all my other brothers and sisters, they were tired and they'd left the room. I sat there with her and I held her hand, and there was nothing left to be said. Absolutely nothing. And it was good. And I didn't cry. It wasn't because I wasn't sad or I wasn't. It was because I knew she was going to a better place, that it was great. And I was happy for her. And that thing that had happened with me, death seems to be the big scary one for, it was for me. Everybody's going to die. And I had lost quite a few. But the 12 steps have given me the ability to have a relationship with a power greater than myself, that I am not afraid of that stuff anymore. Whether they believe it or not, I believe it. And my mother and I had those conversations. And the best gift I could give her or anybody else that I love or says they love me is to never have to worry about me. Never have to worry about me again. It's like that gauge that I make my thoughts, my deeds, and my words over. Because I was that freaking tornado. I sucked the air out of every room I ever walked into, and I made it all about me. And to learn that, I can still do it too. I can still do it. And the morning she died, and I'll be quiet after this, and I had, the scabs were very raw, and I'm with my siblings, and I'm very dysfunctional family, very dysfunctional, but it is what it is. And I was tired. It had been a long year. and I lost my mind in the parking lot of the Catholic church. Lost my mind. And that tornado came right back. And I got to calm myself down and make a call and do this thing we're talking about again. But if I can just not suck the air out of every room I walk into, it's a good day. Thanks.
Thanks, Grace. That I was, during the reading there, I was thinking about my home and the issues that I caused inside of my home. But then Grace got me thinking more about the parents' side of it. And I'm so grateful for Alcoholics Anonymous, because I've come to meetings all these years. I've played golf with all these people all these years that are in recovery. And I've watched people go through dealing with older parents that are at the end, and the effort and the energy and the requirement that takes. And I wasn't in that place. But I came and I listened, and now I'm in that place. And Grace and I were talking before the meeting. She asked how you're doing, and I gave the typical, "Man, everything's great. You know, you do, everything's great." But the reality is I'm tired. I've got a 14-year-old and an 18-year-old. I've got a 20-year marriage, got a career, and I've got two parents that really need my help because they can't get along on a day-by-day basis. Barely taking care of each other. And I too was this tornado. You know, not only did I cause all these problems in my home, but you know what? I've been causing a problem in my parents' home since the minute I entered this world. Long before alcohol took over, I was an alcoholic, because in that house, it was all about me. And what can these two people give me? What lies do I have to tell to get what I need and what I want? Not what I need, because they gave me tons of love. You know, that's one thing that my parents gave, just tons of love. They went to all my sporting events. They told me they loved me on a daily basis, and they were always hugging me. I didn't have any need for anything extra, but I always wanted more than that. And then you start pouring alcohol on top of it, and I need to take even more from them. And I lived selfishly in my parents' life for 36 years. It was all about me. And the alcoholic has a long way to go if he wants to make any good with the parents for whom he's so shockingly treated. And man, I got to put in a lot of work to get to this point. You see what happens to me when I drink? I can't stop. And that's what makes me an alcoholic. And when I'm sober, says shame on the alcoholic who thinks all he needs to do is keep sober. When I'm sober, I'm miserable. When I'm sober, the people in my life say, "Why don't you please start drinking again?" Because we think we like that better, right? I'm still lying. I'm still cheating. I'm still trying to get me in mine, even when I'm not drinking. Like, I've got this disease, right? And alcohol just tends to make it worse and compounds it. So where am I today? I'm trying to make good to these people that have done nothing but love and care for me since the very beginning. This weekend, I had volunteered to take my 18-year-old and his two buddies to and from something in the water. Now, there was some selfish motives in that. I figured, you know, I'd feel a lot better if I was the one picking them up. You know, I can control that situation a little bit more. But what that meant was, you know, some extremely late nights, and I'm a go to bed at 9:30 kind of guy myself. But what that meant was some extremely late nights at a concert that I wasn't going to. But I volunteered to do that. And for some reason, my 18-year-old, I guess he loves me. He said, yeah, Dad, that sounds like a great plan. So I picked these kids up at 2:30 in the morning is when they got done. And then the next day, my mom calls at 10 in the morning and she says, I don't know what to do with your dad. He's confused and he can't get out of bed. And I don't think he's taken his medicine in a couple of days and he hasn't eaten. I said, well, let's call the ambulance. Don't you go anywhere. We'll figure it out once the ambulance leaves. Don't leave. Mom, do not leave. Of course, she leaves and drives her car, which she has. The state still hasn't taken her driver's license. And I don't. No sleep. I'm at the hospital, you know, and I'm answering questions for the doctor because I'm involved in my parents' life. I go over there several times a week for lunch. I use my lunch break to go visit them. And I, you know, spend as much time with them, helping them with whatever it is that they need. And they can't answer the doctor's questions. My sister was out of town, by the way, or normally I'd pawn this off on her, but she was out of town and actually we're big helps. We split the duties 50-50, which is awesome. And I spent all day and all night in that hospital. I finally get my mom home, have to take an Uber back to get my car. She asked if she could give me some cash to pay the Uber driver. I said, Mom, that's not how that works. And Sunday I went and picked my kid up from something in the water. I got back at 2 a.m. again, and then I'm right back in it with my parents. And it's all day until we finally get my dad home late last night. And I'm back over there on my lunch break at 11 o'clock this morning. Dad, have you done everything you're supposed to do? Have you taken your medicine? Mom, what do you need? And it's, you know, it's this long way to go. Like, I can never in their lifetime pay them back for all the pain and the suffering and the misery that they caused me. But what I can do is I can learn from people like Grace, people like Donald that I played golf with. Like, I've watched you people go through this. And you've told me that, Ross, if you keep doing AA, if you keep taking simple actions every day, you can handle anything that's presented to you. And you can do it with grace. And you can do it with dignity. And with grace. quite literally. And that is so true. I have no energy today. You could probably hear it in my voice. Like, I just tired. It's been just a long weekend. And I don't know what tomorrow is going to bring with my parents' health. I don't know what next week's going to bring with my parents' health. But I know that if I'm with you guys, and then if I have an active prayer and meditative life, and if I do the instructions that this book tells me to do, I can show up for the people that love me, for the people that I treated the worst. And if I don't do it with you all, then I don't do it all, at all. So when this home group calls me to ask me to come out here on a Monday night to share my story on step 9 with the person that I shared it with last time at this exact same meeting, then I'm going to say yes, because this is exactly where God wants to get to experience the things that he's sharing.
Our next reading is from page 83. Yes, there is a long period of reconstruction ahead. We must take the lead. A remorseful mumbling that we are sorry won't fill the bill at all. We ought to sit down with the family and frankly analyze the past as we now see it, being very careful not to criticize them. Their defects may be glaring, but the chances are that our own actions are partly responsible. So we clean house with the family, asking each morning in meditation that our Creator show us the way of patience, tolerance, kindliness, and love. The spiritual life is not a theory. We have to live it. Unless one's family expresses the desire to live upon a spiritual principles, we think we ought not to urge them. We should not talk incessantly to them about spiritual matters. They will change in time. Our behavior will convince them more than our words. We must remember that 10 or 20 years of drunkenness would make a skeptic out of anyone.
That makes me chuckle. I could tell stories on that one, on both sides of it. I'm Grace again, alcoholic. And when my mother hadn't passed yet, I am one of 10 children. And it's a mixed up sort of family, his, mine, and ours. And I'm the oldest of them together, but I'm the seventh of the 10. It's very confusing psychologically. Anyway, nobody really liked each other. We found out, you know, we were just pretending. And as each parent was going, the truth started coming out. We were all getting pretty honest with one another. It kills me what it says here. We should sit down with the family and analyze. Sometimes that's not a good thing. But I was taking this very literally. I'm following the instructions in the book. I sat down with my little sister. We actually had the same mother and father. I remember, and I made my amends to her, and I said it like with my spawn. You know, I did it very early on, just like it said. And then my little brother, I did the same thing with him, and I thought, okay, we're good. And so, you know, 5-6 years later, I'm sitting there with my little sister, the one I made the amends to back then. And mom's not doing well. And she and I are tag teaming my mother. God love you boys. But apparently if it's a mother, the daughters do everything, but all they want is their sons. That's all I ever heard. So I don't know if you guys get that. So so my sister and I are pissing and moaning about how much we do and how little they do, and you know, doing this thing. I'm thinking all is well. And I don't know, I don't even remember what I said. But keeping in mind, I think I've made my amends to this blessed child of God. And she says, she fires off at me. She goes, you know, everything's not all about you. Man, it was still there. It was still there. And I thought, I guess this is going to go on a while. And I kept my mouth shut. There it was again. I had practiced a lot of that, keeping my mouth shut and allowing people to have their feelings. I'm not. You know, I'm only responsible for my actions, my side of the story. And just because I may make amends to somebody doesn't mean it fixes it for them. It really, I found that out very clearly then. My little brother that I still, it's an absolute fact. We call them resentments. I wish I could find another word because I'm just sick of it. I've made amends repeatedly. I do it as needed. The reason I do it is because I want relief. And I want to be free of it, however many times it takes, I'm learning a lot. I'm practicing a lot about the benefits of forgiveness too, as being essential to my getting rid of resentment. It's an idea, it's a concept. I won't go squirrel on it, but I'm finding out that that has just as much power as the amends, is forgiveness. And I have to act as if until God does what God. This spiritual life is not a theory thing. It's absolutely, they talk about, you know, the 6 and 7 separating the men from the boys. But this is really where I don't have any more excuses. I know what's wrong and I know what's right. And I have to do the right thing. So where it says we must remember that 10 or 20 years of drunkenness, my problem started long before my alcohol, my drinking started. My relationship issues. My self-centeredness, I think, has been there since I could have a thought. And I don't know what that's about, but it's the truth. Everything felt like it was about me, and everything had to be my way. And the ends always justified the means. I mean, from the time I could first. So that way of thinking really pisses people off, you know, really does. And alcohol had nothing to do with it. I mean, I still think, remember things, and I will use this process till they throw dirt in my face or throw me off a cliff, whichever comes first. Because as I remember the things that I have done, I don't remember them all. I'm old, I did a lot of damage. But as I remember them, I'm willing to do whatever it takes to be free of it. And I'm eternally grateful for stepping out of that material world into the spiritual world. And I don't want to get drugged back.
Thanks, Grace. We ought to sit down with the family and frankly analyze. I've done that in my home with my wife, not just the initial, but also through some marriage counseling. You know, it's taken a little while for me to figure out how to communicate in a marriage. Coming into Alcoholics Anonymous, I did not know how to communicate in my home, which should be quite obvious to anyone if you've heard me speak tonight. So it's taken me a long time to learn how to do that. And I've needed some outside help in analyzing the situation and learning how to effectively communicate the mumblings. Again, a remorseful mumbling. That's what my wife got from me. Either that or the sweep it under the rug and let's just forget about it. But that was how I expressed my sorrow. And that started to change, thankfully. Again, I got a long way to go. I got a lot of work still to do. With my in-laws, it was a much different, conversation. I attempted to analyze, and I love my in-laws, like love them and they love me. And I attempted to analyze the past and I've got a mother-in-law that, just wanted to continue to analyze. And it was a difficult conversation, but thankfully I went into it with a ton of prayer and a ton of meditation and a game plan with someone that knew how to do it, someone that had done it before. And my sponsor too had to make amends to his in-laws, and we had this plan of attack. And thankfully through his help and through the help of God, I was able to get through that experience. And now I must say that I probably hang out with my in-laws far more than even my wife does, which is kind of an odd twist there. With my parents, I'd been sober about 5 or 6 months, and I couldn't quite see the change in me, but apparently in Alcoholics Anonymous, people can see the change in us before we can see it. And I'd gone out with my dad to run an errand, and people have probably heard me say this, but my dad is the exact opposite of me. He's a dredge boat captain, you know, Harley driving, tatted up. I mean, he's a tough dude. I'm just a little hippie guy. But he's a tough individual. And we had gone out to run an errand, and we're driving in his truck and we're having a conversation. And the next thing I notice is that his voice is starting to crack and he's starting to cry. Oh my God, what have I done now? And I look over at him and I was like, Dad, what is wrong? And he says, I finally got my son back. And by the time, you know, it got to make the amends with him, I started to sit down to analyze, and they were both like, no. There's no need to analyze. Just keep going to AA. Just keep going to Alcoholics Anonymous. And that's a promise that I've been able to keep today. And then the spiritual life. It's not a theory. I have to continue each day to pray for the way towards patience, tolerance, kindness, and love, because that is not my nature. My nature is to be judgy. My nature is to get what I want. Yeah, that's my nature. And I have to constantly seek out and ask for these things. And I like the advice that it gives here, where it says we should not talk incessantly to them about spiritual matters. And this is one of the things that I probably hold most dear in life, and give all the credit to God and to Alcoholics Anonymous. When I checked out of rehab, my wife decided that she was going to go on a spiritual journey, and she was going to attempt the Al-Anon path. And so each Sunday we'd get our calendars out, because we've got two kids that are active in sports, and, you know, we've got a lot of stuff going on. And, you know, I'd map out the meetings that I was going to try to hit, or that I was going to hit. And then she would map out the Al-Anon meetings that she was going to hit. And then we'd have to make plans. So one kid was with the baby, and we were both trying the spiritual approach. And then one night she comes in and she says, "Hey, I'm going to go to a meeting tonight that I hadn't planned on. Do you mind?" I was like, "Oh no, absolutely." And so when she comes back from that meeting, I'm sitting in the den, and she pulls out of her pocket a white chip. "Why did you steal my white chip?" And she says, this is mine. I can't quit drinking. And I just went to my first AA. And what had happened, and she'll have to come here and tell her story, but most of you know it, because a lot of you know her. What had happened was, she saw these dynamic changes that God was doing to me. And I was changing rapidly through working these steps and through going to all these meetings and through working with other alcoholics. And she was seeing it. And she said it, she continued to get worse. And we had never really hidden drinking from each other. I hid some other stuff, but we'd never really hidden drinking from each other until she said that she started hiding drinking. And you know what? If God's not real, this never would happen for me. Like, I've tried every which way to do this to myself, and it's not possible. I can't change me. I can't solve alcohol, but God can. And other people saw it, and they saw it so much so that they said, I have to do this thing too. And, you know, I can tell you, and, you know, we talk about it a lot, her and I, that, you know, this program has helped us, but we'll also be the first to admit that we are broken people, and we've required a lot of additional. I mentioned it before, we're terrible at communicating, you know, and it takes practice. It takes a spiritual life to make a marriage at 20 years still work. And if I stop doing this, if I stop asking on a daily basis for God to direct me towards a life of patience, tolerance, kindness, and love, again, I can't do that on my own. I have to ask for his help each day. If not, marriage crumbles, my life crumbles, and I go back to drinking and I end up dead. So I too believe, I'm a believer in the spiritual life is not a theory. For me, it's an absolute fact that God does for me what I can't do for myself.
All right. Our next reading is on page 83 as well. There may be some wrongs we cannot never fully right. We don't worry about them if we can honestly say to ourselves that we would write them if we could. Some people cannot be seen. We send them an honest letter, and there may be a valid reason for a postponement in some cases, but we don't delay if it can be avoided. We should be sensible, tactful, considerate, and humble without being servile or scraping. As God's people, we stand on our feet. We don't crawl before it. And I'll finish up this reading too, since this next reading is on page 83 as well. If we are painstaking about this phase of our development, we will be amazed before we are halfway through. We are going to a new freedom and a new happiness. We will not regret the past, nor wish to shut the door on it. We will comprehend the word serenity, and we will know peace. No matter how far down the scale we have gone, we'll see how our experience can benefit others. That feeling of uselessness and self-pity will disappear. We will lose interest in selfish things and gain interest in our fellows. Self-seeking will slip away. Our whole attitude and outlook upon life will change. Fear of people and of economic insecurity will leave us. We will intuitively know how to handle situations which used to baffle us. We will suddenly realize that God is doing for us what we could not do for ourselves. Are these extravagant promises? We think not. They are being fulfilled among us, sometimes quickly, sometimes slowly. They will always materialize if we work for them.
I'm glad you did it all, just read it all, just knock it out. Encompasses everything. I'm like, man, I have to make a lot of amends. I don't know how I'm gonna get it all in here. So when I got here, I'll just say it. So I hadn't filed taxes in 10 years when I got here, and I had that kept me drunk for a long time. The reality of what and when I got here and I saw the steps and I had some inkling that this ninth step was a come to Jesus moment. You know, I was going to have to, that it was payday. All that emotional, all that tornado roaring through the lives of other people, that didn't have my attention. It was the IRS. That had my attention. And I had lived for years and years and years, the mailbox. I had more fear of the mailbox than the terrorists. I didn't go to the mailbox. The mailman would finally, I would get red tags on the front door. I had to go to the post office. There was no room. They couldn't deliver it. And then I would get somebody else to go get it for me and bring it and put it in the garage in a box where I never had to see it. That's how I dealt with my life. And so when I got sober and the shade started to come up all of a sudden, I told the truth, that honesty crap that y'all talked about. I told my sponsor, I told her about this problem I had with mailboxes. And I had also moved in across the street from my sponsor. And wouldn't you know it, in these townhouses, the mailboxes were directly across the street from her townhouse. So my suggestion, or she called them subtle command, was I had to go to the mailbox every day. And she, so wouldn't you know, I'm getting notices from the IRS. So you know that part in step 8 where it talks about willingness? God's timing is just, and somewhere around that end of the first year, I started, those notices started coming, and I was sober enough, and I was, had made contact enough with a God I could do business with, ergo my sponsor and you guys. that's really who was my God. Then I knew I had to do the next right thing. And so I told her the truth. And I remember when I was getting these notices and they were big. I mean, this wasn't, it was so bad that all I could do was laugh. And it like in a period of a couple of weeks. And I say this number because I've talked about this over the course of my sobriety. And there's always seems to be somebody that approaches me and goes, you survived it? Because I have a problem. And apparently I'm not the only one with IRS issues. So by the end of about, I don't know, we'll say a month, it was about $250,000. That's how bad this was. Okay. This wasn't little. This wasn't something, oh, we can make payments. I was unemployable. I didn't own anything. I had a 20-year-old 3/4-ton Suburban with 220,000 miles on it. You could hose it out. We'd lived in it. I didn't have anything. And I'm telling the truth. And she's like, what are you going to do? And I go, you tell me. Because I don't have a clue. But you know what was really wild about that? I wasn't afraid anymore. Now, what the heck was that about? I was looking at the and laughing. Now, granted, I have an abnormal sense of humor. I would. I laugh. It's a gift, and I'm grateful for it because I got some criers in my little village. but anyway, I made the phone call, and I won't take long, Ross, I promise. I picked up the phone and I called the IRS, and I said, I have to talk to somebody. It's really important. And they're like, who put me on hold? And I sat and I finally talked to somebody, and I spewed all over them. I am in recovery. I was using everything. And you know, it took, I walked through it. I told the truth. And someone in Alcoholics Anonymous, because I talk a lot. And so the meeting, I went to meetings all the time. I went to the same meetings. And you know, you tell people stuff in AA and help shows up. Help shows up. I wasn't afraid. I wasn't afraid that anybody knew. I wasn't trying to keep a secret anymore. I wasn't even asking for help. I was just telling my truth. And lo and behold, someone in AA, he does taxes. He's a tax guy. He says, he met me at, he didn't want me to come to his house. And he didn't want to come to my house. He would meet me at the McDonald's every Sunday. And it was the biggest four-step you have ever seen in your life. It was the years of my drinking. It was the years of my father's death. It was all the stuff. And I had to, and I remember telling the lady at the IRS, I don't remember this stuff. She's going, well, don't you have any paperwork? I go, it was in a box and we burned it. She said, make it up. That's what she did. And I went, really? Do your best. She said, just do your best. If it's not right, we'll let you know. And so I did it. And you know, it took 7 years, 6 or 7 years. They put a lien on. Do you know, I walked away from there and I never paid one. How's that happen? I must have been on the phone with 5 different people when I would tell the story, and I would vomit all over everybody else. And somewhere, somebody in there had a father, a brother, a mother, a sister, a cousin, or something that had been sober in AA for years and years and had saved their life. And they took me to the next place I needed to go. And they told me, don't worry, Grace. And it gave me faith. It gave me faith. I had been afraid my whole life. That's why I lied. I love lying. I'll lie to you before tell the truth in a heartbeat. That's where I lead from. And that gave me faith. And walking through that, of course, I will tell you, I keep that release of lien with every important document I have. I will never lose that. But the promises, it's not that my financial insecurity goes away. It's that my faith is enforced that oversees, that overshines it. It takes care of it. If I do the next right thing, if I live the spiritual life, if I tell the truth, if I'm open-minded and I'm willing. And I sleep well at night, and I didn't sleep for a long time. And the secret and the dirty little crappy things that I did in my life that I've made amends for, whether they've been received and the relationships have been repaired or not, I've done my best. That is what sets me free. That is what set me free. And I can walk down the street and I can walk into any room, and I'll say this real quick. I'm going to go speak at a meeting a couple of weeks down at the beach. And I'm from Virginia Beach, and I did a lot of ripping and roaring down there in my youth, more than I can remember. And I'm sitting in a meeting down there a month or so ago, and I go, this is very familiar. Where am I? And it's a bar. It was a bar. The Potter's House. Now, that was a bar where I was really bad. And I have stayed away from down there because of that. And, you know, I'm going to speak there now. God is funny. God is just funny. Thank you.
Thanks, Grace. Real quick, my mailbox story. So Grace was scared of it. I ran to it every day. And the reason I ran to it every day is that I had, we're going to foreclose on your home. We're going to shut your water off. Your electricity is about to get turned off. Like, these are the note that you owe tens of thousands of dollars to this credit card. So the mail came every day between 12 and 1. My wife got home at 1:30. So every day from work, I would rush home on my lunch break to get all of that mail so that she didn't see it, drive it back to my office, stuff it in the shredder bin. So that's the way that I...
And you're shredding awesome.
And with that, I'll stop. Thanks.
Okay. I'm burning your shred.